I'd like to welcome you all here tonight to this speech given by President Napolitano. He has spoken at the LSE before. He spoke here about 13 years ago, and we've just extracted an invitation from him to speak again in something less than 13 years' time. But it's my great pleasure to welcome him here to the LSE this evening. He probably doesn't need a very long introduction from me, and although I have his CV and a short biography, I'm not going to go all the way through it. I take pleasure in mentioning, though, just a few of the things about him that I think are highlights. He graduated in law, and as a lawyer myself, I can't resist saying that that must be part of one of his special attributes. Graduated in law from Naples University, and I have to say, when you read his biography, it's clear that he was a political radical right from his undergraduate days, and I don't think he's stopped in that role. He's not only a political radical in the various things that he's done throughout his life, but he's also maintained both a very prolific writing career, so that he has a lot of publications to his name, and I'm sure some of the contents of those you have read. I'm afraid I have not. I'm not an Italian reader. He is now the president, and we welcome him in that capacity, but he has occupied quite a number of very, very senior political roles throughout his life. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome him here to speak to us tonight. Topic of his lecture is there a future for European integration? And this is a lecture which I'm sure you'll give us some controversial views. But for the LSE, it's the second event in the LSE's the LSE European Institute's Future of Europe series. This is a series which is supported by FT Business, the specialist publishing arm of the Financial Times, and we thank them very greatly for support for this initiative. It's proving to be quite popular already, and there are lectures coming in the future as part of that series, some of which I'll mention later on. But can we welcome the President to the podium to give you his lecture?
I warmly thank you, Madam, for your welcome, and first of all for inviting me to speak once again in such a prestigious institution. I gladly accepted this invitation, not least since it enables me in my present institutional role to make Italy's voice heard within these walls with proud traditions of free thinking and liberalism on a subject very close to my heart. These traditions I came to know well during many a visit and also to other renowned centers of research and debate, such as Trinity College in Cambridge. I often visited there Piero Sraffa, a scholar and an exceptionally gifted thinker who worked in Cambridge for many years and honored me with his friendship. He was one of those Italians who never lost touch with his native countries. During the dark years of the fascist dictatorship, he generously and discreetly helped a number of prominent anti-fascist figures. But he identified himself so closely with Britain and with the scientific community which had welcomed him openly in the 20s that he chose to live in Cambridge for the rest of his life. I am here today to discuss an issue that has been presented to you in the form of a question. Is there a future for European integration? Although I am a convinced supporter of European unity, thus interpreting and representing a basic and constant tenet of Italian policy and public opinion, I shall not attempt to elude the more problematic and controversial aspects raised by the question. In other words, I shall try to avoid taking a conventional and rhetorical approach. And I shall do so despite the growing tendency, both in Italy and in other member states, to react to oversimplified arguments in favor of European integration with similarly simplistic judgments against. The history of European integration is undoubtedly a great success story. It tells of a community which finally leaves behind the destructive rivalries of European powers and their bloody conflicts for hegemony, of a continent which, out of the ravages of the Second World War, embarked on a process of integration and liberalization, laying the foundations for its own rebirth under the banner of social market economy. It speaks too of a family of nations which gradually spread its model of reconciliation and progress in all countries willing to join. It did so by promoting democracy, abolishing frontiers, and fostering economic and civil advancement in all the nations which, one after another, became members of a project born in the 50s of the last century. It is the story of a union which developed its own institutions and mutually agreed rules together with a common market and a single currency, and which aspires today to achieve growing weight and greater authority on the world scene by speaking with one voice. By surveying the scale and extent of the progress made, what we should ask ourselves is not so much how the Union could have survived so many crises and changes, but how it has been able to achieve so much. And yet our fellow citizens are showing signs of discomfort and concern. The low turnout at the polls in the 2004 European parliamentary elections and the referendum results in France and the Netherlands on the constitutional treaty were clear signs. Few periods in history underwent such a rapid transformation and such a profound upheaval of political, economic, social, and cultural structures. Faced with the complexities of a growingly interdependent and increasingly hard to govern world, some of our fellow citizens are questioning the capacity of the European Union to provide adequate solutions to the pressing problems and challenges of daily life. They include unemployment, immigration, the environment, energy crisis, terrorism, and other threats to international stability. Such concerns are particularly felt among young people who, for the first time, and after decades of uninterrupted economic growth, fear that their incomes will eventually grow more slowly than those of previous generations. It is true that such questions arise over issues that often lie beyond the objective responsibilities of the European Union and outside its competencies. But although national governments bear a fair share of responsibility for dealing with such problems, the European Union represents our most concrete hope for the future. At a time when opportunities and dangers are global in scope, there can be no exclusively national solution. There are indications that over the next 5 years, China's GDP will continue to grow at between 8 and 10%, that the United States will grow at between 2 and 3%, and that the European Union will average a mere 2%. If those trends are confirmed through the subsequent decade, and if emerging economies succeed in achieving their potential, then after 2020, not a single European country would be entitled to sit in a multilateral forum like today's G7. Only a united Europe can successfully take part in global competition and defend the interests of its member states in trade negotiations with the rest of the world. Europe is not lacking in the resources, human, entrepreneurial, scientific, and technological, required to overcome its economic difficulties. But it can only succeed in doing so if certain conditions are met. The single market has to be completed and extended to all sectors, with the removal of all remaining forms of protectionism threatening to compromise the rights of European companies capable of competing on global terms. Competition between enterprises in the various European countries must be free and governed by clear, mutually agreed rules. There must be safeguards against any resurgence of nationalistic tendencies. The Eurozone, and I know Britain has a vested interest in its stability, needs an efficient development strategy. Coordinated and converging reforms are necessary to make our economic systems more compatible with the demands of rapidly changing markets. Governance of the economy, alongside the existing governance of monetary policy, is essential if we are to overcome the challenge of growth so that we can provide wealth to our citizens and contribute to harness the process of globalization. This will involve opening up our markets to trade from the poorer countries and directing investment towards them. It will also require common rules and guarantees of everyone's rights. Europe can only succeed by focusing on quality, advanced technology, and innovation. We must invest in human capital and devote more resources to research. We must foster stronger scientific and cultural exchanges within the Union. Europe used to be the cradle of modern science, the continent where the first universities were born. We cannot allow ourselves to forget it now that the issue of reinforcing the activities and the appeal of our research institutes and centers of learning becomes a vital priority. The first universities were originally international in character, since they were organized so as to promote collaboration between the various naciones that composed them. They arose thanks to the mobility of professors and students. Had it not been for that, Bologna, Oxford, Cambridge, and Paris would have merely remained local schools. The very word university referred to a community of mentors and students from the widest reaches of our continent. Well, in today's Europe, integration cannot be achieved without full freedom to study, travel, and work unhindered. Cultural horizons expand in a space that has no barriers. Opportunities for civil and cultural growth arise, as do chances of training and employment for our youth. Such conditions encourage and at the same time presuppose increased collaboration between scholars from various countries. They promote the creation of community scientific research centers as the European University in Florence. The European Union encourages mobility of both students and teachers. It provides a legal framework for mutual recognition of degrees, certificates, and diplomas. It partly finances such mobility by offering grants for students and teachers visiting to attend one of more than 2,000 universities in 31 European countries. The European Union has helped 2 million young people to study abroad, learn new languages, and discover the legacy and cultures of different nations, thus instilling in them a sense of belonging to a single community of shared values. Centuries-old assumptions and prejudices have begun to crumble and disappear. With their wide variety of forms and great wealth of content, classes taught in Europe's university seek to achieve the same common task and goal: the development of individuals, the spreading of a knowledge which consistently promotes a deeper understanding of human and social realities, an education truly conscious of its own traditions, but also aware of the possibility and need for continuous evolution and change. But let me go back to the very beginning of the European adventure. The resolve of the founding fathers of the European community and of the generations which came after the war has been crucial to avoid the outbreak of new destructive conflicts in the heart of our continent. But that is no longer perceived as a sufficient basis for further integration. Thanks to more than 60 years of uninterrupted peace in Europe, our youth tend to consider war as a remote specter as a threat of no direct concern. At the same time, in a world that is becoming increasingly globalized, they witness the crisis and the conflicts, the inequality and poverty, which still characterize so many regions, both near and far from Europe, and perceive them as part of their lives and as a challenge to their own consciences. No future can exist without a memory of the past. That memory must be preserved, but the Union is called upon to offer new perspectives for the future. By clearly indicating the direction it intends to follow, Europe will succeed in fostering a strong sense of European identity in all its member nations. That is the prerequisite for engaging in any ambitious or difficult political undertaking. It is now up to Europe to consolidate peace over the whole continent, bringing Western Balkans into the Union and contributing to a grand design aimed at constructing peace in the world and creating a more just and secure international order. This requires a great capacity for joint action in the fields of foreign policy, security, and defense. Although Europe and the world are no longer divided, as we know, in two blocks, no longer dominated by the confrontation between opposing superpowers, we are called on to respond to challenges and threats that undermine peace and civil coexistence. Those challenges include rapidly growing immigration due to a declining birth rate in our countries and pressure from disinherited masses fleeing the world's poorest regions in search for less inhuman working and living conditions. Defining joint policies in this field thus appears increasingly urgent. As a matter of fact, the vitality of the European model also depends on our capacity to integrate new forces and energies from the outside. With all their various cultural heritages and different identities, and to bring them into our system of rights and values. By developing a fruitful dialogue between Europe's citizens and residents coming from outside our boundaries, we shall succeed in strengthening the civil tradition of a continent which has always been influenced by multiple encounters, syntheses, and osmosis, for coping with diversity is the very basis of the Union's cohesion. The threat of international terrorism generated by Islamic fundamentalism, which suddenly emerged with the appalling attack of September 11, must be faced with all necessary means, including Europe's contribution to military missions such as those promoted by the United Nations. Such a threat requires, at the same time, to remain open to dialogue between different cultures and religions and to effectively integrate foreign communities. And in doing so, we should not force their assimilation nor give up to preserving the legacy of principles and values which distinguish our nations and our states. The development of a common foreign and security policy and the creation of a common space of freedom, security, and justice in Europe are closely intertwined. They are two parts of the same objective of reinforcing at the same time the cohesion of European societies and the role of Europe in such a complex world. Nor can there be any doubt about the importance of the transatlantic ties, the need for intensified collaboration between Europe and the United States in order to operate a successful strategy of peace and security. A strategy aimed at stopping the advance of terrorism, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and illegal international trafficking. Renewed transatlantic ties are essential to both sides. Unforeseen confrontations lie in store, and no superpower can hope to control them alone. Looking from a European perspective at all the changes that have occurred in recent history, we cannot but feel powerfully stimulated to abandon visions that have long been overtaken. The warning which Jean Monnet issued in concluding his memoir in 1976 is more relevant today than ever. I quote, "We cannot stop when the whole world around us is in motion." Today our peoples must, just as our provinces did yesterday, learn to live together and under freely agreed rules and institutions if they wish to achieve the dimensions needed for them to progress and keep control over their destinies. The sovereign nations of the past no longer provide the right framework for resolving the problems of today. End of the quotation. What those words spoke of was not the need for mere collaboration or traditional alliances between sovereign states, but of integration leading to forms of shared sovereignty in which powers are conferred by sovereign nations to supranational institutions. That was the path which Europe followed in moving to closer unity from the 50s on. It featured a unique combination of a new supranational institutions such as the European Commission and the European Parliament, and institutions such as the Council of Ministers and the European Council representing member nations. Individual nations did not disappear, nor did they lose their own identity. They undoubtedly still retain a relevant role. This formed the basis for the gradual enlargement of the European Union's membership from 6 to 15, then from 15 to 25, and soon 27. The reunification of Europe in democracy and peace was made possible by the fall of the communist regime of Central and Eastern Europe, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the end of the continent's decades-old division into opposing blocs. The question now is whether the political will is there in our countries to continue that process of integration. Or, on the contrary, is there a risk of suspicions and fears prevailing? Is the temptation of settling for less ambitious goals making ground? Let us face up those suspicions and fears. What causes misunderstanding and concern seems above all the word integration, the very idea of integration itself. I am aware of raising a delicate issue here, a question to which the United Kingdom is particularly sensitive because it goes to the very heart of national sovereignty. My view is that those fears are unfounded. People have argued that the state objective of an ever closer integration conceals the aim of completely abolishing sovereign states. But that was not the expression used in the European Community founding treaty and in the Treaty of Maastricht. What they rather use is another very different formula, an ever closer union among the peoples of Europe. The potential misunderstanding was, however, taken into account, and a different wording was used in the preamble and articles of the Rome Treaty of 29 October 2004. I should like to dwell a little longer on the significance of that treaty, not so much to go into the merits of the political debate over its fate. You already know my strong belief in the necessity to complete the ratification process as a democratic obligation toward those European citizens who have already expressed their will to ratify. 18 out of 27 have ratified so far. We owe them respect. We should always listen to our people's voice. Anyhow, I rather prefer to discuss here some of the general implications raised by the recent political debate and clarify an issue that may be felt as divisive by European public opinion. To be clear, a more widespread fear than the one about the wording I just mentioned concerned and still concerns what is perceived as a creeping expansion of the competencies of the Union, and more specifically, the growing initiatives of the European Commission. This, it has been argued, had happened in the past and could well continue in the future. But a very clear and open debate took place on just that point in the Convention on the Future of Europe held in Brussels from 2002-2003. That discussion aimed at providing satisfactory answers to the concerns voiced by a number of countries, including the United Kingdom. the new treaty in the text then agreed by the Intergovernmental Conference and signed in October 2004 set out with unprecedented clarity what the Union's exclusive areas of competence were and reaffirmed the principles of subsidiarity and proportionality. A special protocol was devoted to those principles in which the various modalities of their application were clearly defined and guaranteed. Full account was taken of the need to keep the Commission from intervening over invasively and from expanding its legislative role too much. Tighter rules, as a matter of fact, were introduced, and national parliaments were given the right to dispute projects submitted by the Commission or other organs of the Union, and if necessary, to have them re-examined or withdrawn. If those are the fears that have grown up in government circles and public opinion in various countries, prompting demands for change in the practices that gradually took ground in the Union, then the 2004 treaty clearly created the right conditions for bringing about such change. But another, more important change was and is required to respond to the dissatisfaction with and detachment from the European project expressed by those European citizens who feel left out of the Union's decision-making process and powerless to influence it. In effect, this raises the question of democracy in the Union. This issue is partly addressed by giving great power to the European Parliament and strengthening relations between the European and national parliaments, but it also calls for new and systematic form of consultations with civil society and the novel form of participatory democracy as well as social dialogue. This too, however, was widely discussed at the Brussels Convention, which reached important solutions that were agreeable to all the 25 governments. Naturally, there can be no strengthening of democracy in the Union if the democratic legitimacy of the European Parliament is put into question, notwithstanding the fact that it is elected by universal suffrage just as any other freely elected parliament. Nor can democracy be reinforced in the Union if such legitimacy is recognized only to national institutions and in particular to national parliaments. These bodies should certainly have a greater voice in the decision-making process with greater control over the policies expressed by their respective governments in the Council of Ministers and with more attention to them paid by the European Parliament. But the latter's role remains crucial. Lastly, it is right to maintain that many things should change as far as the Union's policy options are concerned. Starting with its budget priority, as suggested, I must recall, by a recent report sponsored by the European Commission itself. Also to be reconsidered is the Union's capacity to effectively implement the innovative policies that have been announced, from the Lisbon strategy to the reform of the labor market, and I am referring here to the Wim Cox report. But difficulty of reluctance in proceeding in that difficulty or reluctance in proceeding in that direction largely depends on a lack of political will, or if you prefer on a crisis of political leadership. And that can be remedied only if decision makers in all member states take the time to reflect on the radical changes which have taken place on the world stage and in our own societies. By doing so, they become more aware of the renewed need to forge ahead with the process of integration in a Europe that is now reunited. Modern politics and economics have not just a national or global dimension. There exists also a European dimension, as shaped and brought into operation by the integration of our countries in the Community of Six and now in the Union. Demand for Europe has been growing and is now heard throughout the world. We have a duty to respond to this call. And if, as Prime Minister Blair powerfully declared In a speech to the European Parliament in June 2005, no one wants to retreat to a common market because Europe, they are Prime Minister Blair's words, because Europe is a political project and the Union is a common political space in which we live as citizens, we must draw the appropriate conclusions together. First and foremost, we should produce a treaty which, whatever its name, solemnly confirms the framework of principles, rights, objectives, institutions, and rules in which all members of the Union can recognize themselves after the Great Enlargement, and which makes the Union an unprecedented and united community of states and peoples. No academic dispute over the term constitution can take away this necessity from us. It should be kept well in mind in discussing how to resolve the crisis over ratification of the treaty, which was signed in October 2004, on the basis, let's not forget it, of a difficult compromise reached after long negotiations. The other consequence to be drawn from a reflection on the lasting validity of the European political project, now more relevant and irreplaceable than ever, is to renew and strengthen the Union's institutions. It's not enough to claim a Union with projects and results. No one can take decisions and see them through. No one can respond convincingly to their citizens in terms of delivery if the rules for deciding by majority vote, if necessary, are missing, and if stronger institutional means are lacking. Do we really want a common foreign and security policy? Well, then we must, as the treaty agreed, provide ourselves with a Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Union supported by a European External Service. And we must equip ourselves with a structure for permanent cooperation in the field of defense. The European Council's unanimous decision in June to participate in a United Nations mission in Lebanon, in a situation critical to the return of peace in an area of crucial interest, represented an important signal of newfound unity and political will at the highest level in the Union. But we need to create the proper institutional conditions enabling Europe to develop a capacity for initiative systematically, as well as an enhanced presence on the world scene. I will not go into it now, but it is also clear to all of us what new decision-making rules and institutional instruments are needed in the Union if the Union is to be allowed to deal also with the challenges and threats I mentioned earlier in my remarks. All of us together need to think of Europe as a community, in the name of its value, its history, and its traditions, while we must cultivate a sense of common destiny. We must turn it into a community capable of action because it is united in diversity. With this aim in mind, a precious stimulus in identifying the changes needed in how the Union is managed has come and may again do so from the United Kingdom. Your country, with its own sensibility, deriving from its own history, but then the history of every European nation is different from all others, contributed decisively to the birth of the European ideal. First, by standing up heroically against Nazi fascism during the Second World War. Then by pointing, as Winston Churchill did in a prophetic speech, to the prospect of a regional organization of Europe to be undertaken without delay, I quote, if we are to form a United States of Europe, or whatever name it may take, we must begin now. End of the quotation. And in effect, the great enterprise of European integration was launched some years later with a different name, Community. The endeavor goes on. It is not over, and Europe still needs United Kingdom as a source of equilibrium on the continent, and as an inspiration for its civil and democratic future. We are about to celebrate in a few months the 50th anniversary of the Treaty of Rome. But in the words of that speech in Zurich long ago, we still need an act of faith in the European family. Thank you.
Take them one at a time, so you'll be in the privileged group if you catch my eye first. I think there are roving microphones. Can I ask you to keep the question short and also to give your name and your affiliation before you start asking the question?
Thank you, Mr. President, for coming here to LSE. I'm just an Italian student here, and I wanted to ask you a question on the enlargement of the European Union. You know that in January 2007, Bulgaria and Romania will join the European Union. The negotiations with Turkey are underway. Therefore, it seems that geography, culture, and religion seem to pose no hindrance to the enlargement of the European Union. So I wanted to ask you, are there any limits to this enlargement of the European Union? Thanks.
I'm Matthias, I'm a research student in the European Institute here at LSE, and I'm wondering how the stance of the current Italian government is influenced by the fact that Romano Prodi was president of the European Commission from 1999 to 2004. Thanks.
Excuse me, could you just repeat that? I didn't quite catch, so we're not quite clear on the question. Sorry.
I'm wondering how the fact that Romano Prodi was president of the European Commission from 1999 to 2004, if this has an influence on the current stance of the Italian government.
Thank you. Sorry about that. One more. President
Napolitano.
Very loudly, sorry.
It's on. Can you hear me?
Yes, that's much better.
President, as you pointed out in your speech, one of the main tasks of the European Union is to secure stability and peace in the region and in the world in general. In this respect, what is your and Italy's view on the ongoing conflict between Russia and Georgia? And what is your view what the EU approach should be?
You get the easy questions. Okay, three simple questions. Over to the President.
They could be more complicated. Anyhow, I'll do my best. The first question about enlargement. Yes, Romania and Bulgaria practically have already accepted in and a negotiation has been opened with Turkey. The difference is relevant because this negotiation looks to be a rather long negotiation. It has just started. There are many problems to deal with. Of course, it's understandable the question whether there is any limit to enlargement. I think there are some limits. Perhaps the most important limit is not to have a union hard to govern, harder and harder to govern. And of course, if you enlarge without having proper institutional reforms,
you run the risk to have a larger union but ineffective union. And we cannot put at risk the integration process and its philosophy. This is my opinion. You did mention West Balkans. West Balkans are some of them already candidates, in particular Croatia, and we have to discuss very seriously this perspective, because I think that Europe needs to give a solution to problems of West Balkans. That can be a highly unstable area, and the only way perhaps to overcome all tensions which have taken place in those countries of the former Yugoslavia is to take them in the system of values and rules of the European Union. So my opinion is clearly favorable to the enlargement to the West Balkans. Prodi Commissions, perhaps I didn't fully understand the question. If you want an opinion from me on the achievements of Prodi, Romano Prodi's European Commission, I can say that I observed the activity of that commission during the same 5 years in which I was the chairman of the Constitutional Committee in the European Parliament. And I am convinced that the Prodi Commission made a good job, particularly as regards enlargement, which was perhaps the main objective, and it was successful, enlargement to 10 and very soon 12 new member countries. And I think that he gave a remarkable impulsion also to an institutional reform, more exactly to a constitutional project, also on some very controversial questions which have not been solved. Anyhow, the contribution of Prodi's commission cannot be underrated. I quoted two reports which have been adopted under the auspices of the Prodi's commission: the Sapir report on the necessary transformation of the budget of the European Union, and the Koch report on the necessary reform of the labor market. That shows that there was much attention paid by the Commission also to these new problems and necessities, although they are, I think, tasks of a longer period. Stability and peace, well, all of us, we know that is a fundamental responsibility of the Union to give its contribution in diffusing stability and peace outside European boundaries. And I think that there cannot be any exception. So we cannot ignore the situation which exists, you said, in Chechnya and in Georgia too. And I think that there cannot be a position of indifference of the European Union vis-à-vis those very serious conflicts. This is my conviction. Of course, there can be so many diplomatic opportunities and prudence, but fundamentally we cannot ignore those situations, and we must try to give a solution also to those conflicts within Russia. Thank you. Within Russia or at the borders of Russia.
Very good. Could you just give me another couple of minutes to say thank you properly? As I said, this is the FT Business European Institute lecture series on the future of Europe. I think you'll agree with me that next week's speakers, and there are two of them, have a hard act to follow. Next week's speakers are the Turkish Economy Minister, Ali Babacan, on Tuesday, and Professor Timothy Garton-Ash from Oxford on Thursday. It never ceases to amaze me, the caliber of the speakers we get here at the LSE. They generously contribute their time. They come and speak to very often a packed audience like this. And I think you'll agree that we've been privileged tonight. It's been a real pleasure to have you here talking on the future of European integration. I think you don't get to be the president without having certain attributes, but that was a really clear, broad in scope assessment of the question. And what I really liked about it was absolutely clear, simple principles that govern the way you're approaching the issues. So can I say thank you very much. It's been a privilege and a pleasure.